The most important and most critical question, in my view, is who are we in relationship to each other, in relationship to life on earth, and in relationship, yes, to God?
Get happy. Der Achtsamkeitspodcast von Antenne Bayern. Und hier ist Kati Kleff.
Hallo ihr lieben Menschen, ich wünsche euch einen wunderbaren heiligen Abend. Ich hoffe, ihr habt jetzt ein paar freie, erholsame und friedvolle Tage vor euch und könnt nach diesem super anstrengenden Jahr ein bisschen durchschnaufen. Diese heutige Sonderfolge, die wird hoffentlich einen kleinen Teil dazu beitragen, denn die ist wirklich etwas ganz Besonderes, übrigens auch für mich persönlich. Und zwar nicht nur, weil ich meinen ersten englischsprachigen Gast habe, sondern weil dieser Mann zu einem der bedeutsamsten spirituellen Lehrern der Neuzeit gehört. Ich freue mich unglaublich, dass er dabei ist. Die erste Hälfte seines Lebens, die verläuft augenscheinlich erstmal irgendwie ganz normal. Er hat Familie, er ist verheiratet und steht auch beruflich gut, stabil und erfolgreich da. Er arbeitet als Verleger in den Bereichen Marketing, Medien, er ist sogar eine Zeit lang Radiomoderator in den USA. Aber Anfang der 90er Jahre soll sich sein Leben für immer verändern. Da ist er Anfang 50. Er wird bei einem Autounfall schwer verletzt. Ein Feuer zerstört sein Haus und seine gesamten Besitztümer. Seine Ehe zerbricht, er verliert seinen Job und landet am Ende obdachlos und völlig zerbrochen auf der Straße. Um zu überleben, sammelt er Aluminiumdosen und bringt sie gegen Cash auf einen Recyclinghof. Die Nächte verbringt er in einem Zelt am Rande der Kleinstadt Ashland in Oregon. Er ist allein, voller Verzweiflung, Hoffnungslosigkeit und großer Angst. Und er ist voller Groll auf sich, auf das Leben und auf Gott. Um diesen Groll irgendwie loszuwerden, setzt er sich eines Nachts hin und beginnt, einen sehr wütenden Brief an seinen Schöpfer zu schreiben und ihm viele, viele Fragen zu stellen. Und Gott antwortet ihm. Der Rest ist Geschichte und wurde bis heute über 15 Millionen Mal verkauft und in 37 Sprachen übersetzt. Seine Gespräche mit Gott, Conversations with God, zählen zu den bekanntesten und inspirierendsten Werken der gegenwärtigen spirituellen globalen Bewegung. Er gehört keiner Kirche oder Glaubensrichtung an. Er ist einfach ein ganz normaler Mensch, der eine tiefe Verbindung und Verbundenheit zu Gott hat. Oder zu der Kraft, die wir Gott nennen. Und damit das, was er zu sagen hat, auch möglichst viele Menschen inhaltlich verstehen, gibt es von dieser Folge zwei Versionen. Und zwar eine mit deutschen Übersetzungen und eine in der englischen Originalversion. Und dann entscheidet ihr einfach selbst, welche ihr euch anhört. Oder ihr hört einfach beide. Diese hier ist die englische Originalversion. Was für eine große Freude und Ehre. Ich sage herzlich willkommen. Welcome, Neil Donald Walsh.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here with you. How may I serve the moment?
Oh, you're already serving the moment. Thank you so much. It's a great, great honor that you take your time and talk and speak with us about God, because it's the night before Christmas. And I thought this is a very, very good opportunity to talk about God. Would you agree?
It was the night before Christmas, and all through the house, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. Boy, let's talk about God.
Yeah, boy, let's talk about God. Neil, do you think that the time around before Christmas is the time when people all over the world get in contact with God? Mostly that this is the time they come close to God, or closer than the rest of the year?
I hope so. It is for some people. Not everyone has a background that includes Christmas as their celebration of God's existence. So what you're saying is probably true for the world's Christians. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that it's true for the world's Muslims or for the world's Jews or for the world's Buddhists. True. Or for the world's Hindus, which is, I might add, several billion people.
Yeah.
So when you make the kind of statement that you make, that Christmas is the time of year when most people come closest to God, I would say I'm not sure that that's true for most people, but I know that it's true for Christians. I think that Christianity is the largest religion on the earth, so probably 2.5 billion people are Christian, which leaves the rest of the world embracing other understandings and other belief systems. But it's true that there are probably 6 or 7 billion people that are not necessarily embracing Christmas as the birth of God on earth as Christians do.
Yeah. This is a very important point right at the beginning of this interview. You are totally 100% right, because there are a lot of people all over the planet and they have a total different picture or idea of God. And I absolutely agree that God has probably nothing to do with religions, right?
I agree with you that God has nothing to do with religions. I'm not sure that many people realize that there are actually 4,300 religions and belief systems. Wow. On the earth. I mean, organized religions and belief systems on the planet right now. And I don't believe that our deity, our highest power, really has anything to do with any of them in the sense of requiring human beings to believe in one of them and not the other.
Mm.
In fact, God, in my understanding, God does not require human beings to believe anything
mm-hmm.
in particular, but rather simply invites human beings to use the wonderful gifts that God has given all of us with which to create the life that we would like to experience on this wonderful, beautiful planet.
Yeah. Well, I hope we're coming a bit closer to the idea of God in this conversation we have in this next 50 minutes. But at the beginning, I would like to know, it's been a year since you published your last book, The God Solution. And, well, there is still so much chaos and mess in this world. How do you feel about that whole situation from your perspective? How was this last year for you personally?
Well, I'm kind of looking at them as an extraordinary opportunity to perhaps shake us awake, to maybe cause a larger number of human beings to ask some really important and basic and critical questions. The most important and most critical question, in my view, is who are we in relationship to each other, in relationship to life on earth, and in relationship, yes, to God? Who really are we? What is our true identity in relationship to those other aspects of life that we are observing? And I don't think that people have been asking that question in a really serious way with the courage to embrace an answer that they've not already heard, an old ancient answer, until recent times. But I do think that, with, as you put it, all the crazy things that have been happening on the earth, not just in the past year, but in the past several years, I think that maybe we are finding ourselves asking a really important question. Is it possible, just possible, that there's something we don't fully understand here about God, about ourselves, and about life, the understanding of which would change everything? So when you ask me, you know, what is my response or what is my reaction to this past crazy year, my answer is, I'm deeply hopeful, not convinced, but I'm deeply hopeful that it could cause a larger number of people to just stop and to ask themselves, Do we have all the data? Do we have all the information? Is this all there really is to know? Mm. What we now know, is this all there really is to know about life and about God and about ourselves? Or is some data missing? And because if this is really all there is to know, why is life continually such a mess, such a tragedy for so many people? Why is it so difficult, so hard? It can't have been meant to be this difficult and this hard for so many people. There must be something we don't know yet, the knowing of which would change everything. So my answer to your question is, I'm deeply hopeful that this moment in human history will be the time when we simply gather the courage to ask, is it possible that we've got something wrong here? Or at least, if we don't have something wrong, at least, as I said, that we don't have all the information. Is there some data missing? Mm. And I think we are starting to ask those questions. The challenge, however, is that most people don't like change. And so when somebody comes up with new data that suggests that what we have always understood may not be the whole picture, there's huge resistance to that by the largest number of human beings. I'm reminded, for instance, just to give you an example, I'm reminded of the year 1603, when a gentleman named Galileo said, I've just discovered that the earth revolves around the sun. And of course, the largest number of people believed that the sun revolved around the earth. Because that's what the church taught. And the church said, no, you don't understand. We are the center of the universe. Mm. Human beings are the most important beings in the universe. And of course, the sun revolves around the earth because the earth is the center of the universe. So when Galileo proved that it wasn't true with scientific evidence, he, of course, was excommunicated by the church. Mm. And it took the Catholic Church, sadly, 350 years for the Catholic Church to say, actually, Galileo was right. What we need now are some idea heroes who are willing to say, maybe there's more data missing, that we don't have all the information collected about God and about who we are and about how life works. Mm. And that would take great humility on the part of a species, namely human beings, that tends to be very arrogant and tends to resist any kind of change. Don't tell me anything different from what I've already been told. I don't want to hear about any changes in the information that we have. So it's going to take a great deal of courage for us to maybe even ask the question. And if you think they're scared to argue about these things, wait till we start having discussions about God. Mm-hmm. Now we're really talking about something that we're afraid to even have a conversation about.
I am not afraid to have a conversation about God.
Oh, okay. Well, then you're going to hell.
Well, I don't think I'm going to hell. I think I'm probably closer to her than ever before in my life.
Oh, my God. You actually call God possibly a her?
Yes, I do.
Everybody knows. Everybody knows that God is a male. God is not a
is
her.
She?
How can you say something such that's blasphemy? How can you talk like that?
Personal experience. Okay, I tell you a secret. I had a meditation about a year ago, and in this meditation, I was sitting at a long wooden table. And suddenly, right into this trance or meditation, I felt a kind of presence on my left. It was not a person or some other creature. It was just a presence or an energy. And I was turning to the left, and a deep understanding went right through my whole body, and I got these goosebumps all over. And I was thinking, wow, now I understand God is female. It's a female energy sitting at this table with me.
Wow. You really are a radical person. And I can't imagine that people wouldn't be scared of you. But I'm going to let it go at that, because you could be right, of course. God is not male or female. Obviously, God is that aspect of life which is not a gender. God is not a person who walks around. Well, no, wait a minute. Maybe, now that I think about it, maybe God is a person, you know, with a white beard and long white hair, who once in a while wears glasses and
and who's wearing a blue shirt all the time, just like you, maybe.
A blue shirt most of the time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that's God's favorite color.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't wear blue shirts, you're going to hell. Yeah, it could be, but maybe there's more to know on this subject.
Mm.
It might be that we don't have the whole story.
Yeah.
And you know what's interesting, though, Reed, to get serious for a moment? In every other area of human endeavor, we keep exploring. We keep exploring in the area of science.
Mm-hmm.
We keep exploring in the area of technology. We keep exploring in the area of medicine. Because if we didn't keep moving forward and asking questions and exploring in those areas, we would never have had the wonderful medical miracles, the wonderful scientific discoveries, the wonderful technologies that we've created here just in the past 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have these technologies if we didn't keep exploring. But in the one area that may be the most important area of human endeavor, called theology, our understanding of God, we stopped exploring. No, no, you're not supposed to ask any questions. No, no, it's all there in the book. Just read the book, Neil, and stop asking questions.
And why is that? What do you think?
Well, of course, we hate change and we don't want to, and of course we're afraid that we've been taught by our elders, we've been taught by the world's religions, that if we don't embrace and accept what we have been told about God, that God, in fact, will judge us, condemn us, and punish us.
Mm-hmm.
Let me give you one example, in case somebody might think I'm making this up.
Mm-hmm.
When I was 9 years old, I went to a Catholic school. And when I was 9 years old, I was told by the priest who came by once a week and taught the children catechism. Catechism is the doctrine and the dogma of the Catholic Church. And the priest told us that if we miss Mass on Sunday, if we don't go to Mass on Sunday, and without a good excuse, if we had a good excuse, okay. If you're caring for a sick parent, or if you have to work on Sunday, or some reason you can't make it, then it's okay. But if you just go to play golf or just decide you're too sleepy that day and maybe you'll go next week. And if you get hit by a car, tragic accident, or for some reason die on Monday, you're going straight to hell. The priest told us you're going, and he wasn't kidding. He said, you're going to hell.
To a 9 year old.
Yes. To a groups of 9 year olds in the class, unless you get to confession and confess your sins. Well, now, you know what's interesting about that? That particular week, as luck would have it, I missed Mass.
Mm-hmm.
Because I decided I want to go play baseball. And I went to the playground to be with the other kids because I didn't know that it was that big of a deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I go to Mass almost every Sunday, but it would be okay if I missed Mass one Sunday. Now, then the priest is telling me this on Wednesday, and I am racing to the confessional. I'm 9 years old, of course, so I believe the priest.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm racing to the confessional, hoping that I don't get hit by a car. I'm looking both ways. You know, I'm 9 years old. Oh, my gosh. What happens if I die? I don't want to go to hell. Please, God, don't send me to hell. So I go to the confessional, and I tell the priest, you know, I missed Mass on Sunday. It was my own fault. I went to play at the playground.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was forgiven. You know, I was given penance.
Lucky you.
So, whoa.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's worse than that. I'll tell you one other story. When I was in third grade, the nuns, the sisters, told us about baptism.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, you know, what is baptism? Well, it's a sacred sacrament in the church, but children who are not, I mean, babies who are not baptized will not be allowed to return to God in heaven. And we're like, oh, what? God would send a baby to hell because it wasn't baptized by its parents? And the sister said, no, it wouldn't go to hell. It goes to limbo. Mm-hmm. Limbo? We're sitting in class. Limbo? What's limbo? Well, limbo is not heaven or hell. It's just kind of a place where you can't ever experience the joy of being with God in heaven. But I said, we're all asking the sister, raising our hands, you know, our innocent little third grade hands. But sister, it's not the baby's fault. But the baby can't go by itself. What if the parents? Or then we would always try to stump. We played a game called Stump the Sister. Sister, what if the parents are on their way to church for the baptism and the baby's in the car and they do have that terrible accident we hope never happens and the baby dies? Surely in that situation, God would accept the baby back in God's arms in heaven, right? And the sister, I'm sorry, my son, but the baby must be baptized. There are no exceptions.
This is so crazy. I mean, we can laugh about it.
I'm making this stuff up, and people might be listening, thinking Neil's exaggerating. No.
I experienced the same things. So,
yeah, if you were raised in the Catholic Church, you understand. I'm not exaggerating. Mm. We have been taught of a God who will actually punish us if we don't obey God's laws. Mm. But what are God's laws? Well, now that depends on which book you're reading. The Bhagavad Gita, the Book of Mormon, the Upanishads, the Quran, the Bible, the Talmud. I hope you're reading the right book or you're going to be in trouble.
God, it hurts when you're talking about that. It's unbelievable. Do you remember how you've been feeling like a little kid, 9 years old, imagining that there is a God punishing you if you don't do the right things? How did you feel?
Scared. Of course I remember.
And did it make sense to you?
Well, it didn't when I got a little older. Mm-hmm. You know, when I was 9 years old, I was taught to respect authority. And the priest is coming into the room looking like Bing Crosby and going my way in the movie. So, of course, how was I not going to believe the priest? But when I was around 10 or 11, as I got into my middle of my childhood, 12 years old, I finally said, wait a minute. Somebody must have something wrong here. This can't be the way it is.
You know, this is so interesting because this experience, I've been talking about this with a lot of my guests in this podcast. And I remember I felt just the same. I was thinking and feeling when I was 11 or 12 years old, okay, if there is a God in heaven, it doesn't make any sense to me. Why would he be punishing us or judging us? Or it didn't make sense.
And it's not just one church, as I said.
I know, I'm Protestant, so it was the same.
Many, many, many other religions teach doctrines that are equally puzzling and equally improbable. Mm. I mean, really? Mm. If you're a female, you have to cover your body from head to toe, and you can only have a little slit for your eyes. Mm. And you may not leave your house unless you're in the company of a male relative. And you may not vote. And you may not go to school and be educated because you're female.
Yeah, it's
really
absurd. Yeah.
I mean, really?
And I believe it's one of the reasons why it's so difficult and hard for people to believe in God. Because why should I believe in something that is just punishing me and judging me for the things I'm doing so-called wrong? But I don't know. In times like these, I really do believe that it's so important to rely on something and to believe in something that is full of hope and love and positive energy. Because I don't know how it is in the US, but people in Europe and also especially in Germany, they seem to be so separate from each other. And I don't believe that this is our human nature. We are and should be connected, right?
Of course, it's not our human nature. But we have been frightened. We have been scared out of our minds by the religions. And the invitation of religion today is to see if we can't generate a new way of being human without using fear as a tactic, without using fear as the motivation. And that's the challenge that's being faced by all the world's religions today. Where would we be without our fear of God? You know, in America, I don't know how it is elsewhere, but in America, it's really a big thing to say, I'm a God-fearing man. Mm-hmm. We admire people who say, I'm a God-fearing man. Really? Really? I'm a God-loving man. I'm not afraid of God. But maybe I should be. Maybe I'm going to hell. I could be wrong. And I don't know what to say. But if I'm going to hell, you know, what did George Bernard Shaw say a few years ago about going to hell? He said, well, if I'm going to hell, at least that's where all the interesting people are.
Yeah, I mean, we don't know. Maybe this is when the fun part begins. We don't know. Neil, some people say that it needs a huge crisis for a human being to wake up. And it was the same in my case, and it was the same in your personal biography. You had a very hard time at your early 50s, and you had to go through it, and then finally you woke up. When we take this and put it all over the planet, does the human race need a huge crisis like this we are all into right now? Do we need this to finally wake up as a as a collective? You know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean, and I hope the answer is no. I've been told in my conversations with God that we don't really need a crisis in order to awaken. That in fact, many people have awakened without a crisis, just out of their desire, out of a deep desire to know. Some people have emerged from a meditation, no crisis at all, just having a deep meditation. One guy who did that, he meditated for a long time under what was called the Bodhi tree. And when he came out of his meditation, there was no crisis. He simply suddenly had complete enlightenment and complete awareness. They called him Buddha. His name was Siddhartha Gautama, but he demonstrated that, wait a minute. Crisis is not required for enlightenment or for awakening to occur, but it can certainly encourage awakening. There's no question about that, but it's not required. And so I don't know that it's necessary for people to somehow, you know, be up against the wall and nowhere else to go. That many people have been awakened by simply moving into a place of deep desire to truly understand who they are, who God is, and the whole purpose of life. But I hope that, that, you know, what's going on now on the planet will at least inspire enough people to ask some questions, so that we might travel a different road, take the road less traveled.
Neil, I told your story at the beginning of this interview to our listeners today, and I would like to take you back on a little journey to the early 90s. When you imagine this Neil Donald Walsh at the beginning of his 50s, he lost everything. He lost his job. He lost his family. He lost his home. He was deeply desperate and very, very, very angry. When you get in contact with this Neil from the today perspective, how do you feel about that man? Or what would you say to him? What would you tell him?
I would say, I'm glad you woke up. I would say, I'm glad you came to an awareness of who you are and why you're here and the purpose of life. I would say, good going. Nice work. Sorry it took you so long. Sorry it took you over a half century to understand and to begin treating other people as who they really are and to begin behaving in a way that would demonstrate who you really are. Sorry it took you so long, but better late than never.
Absolutely.
And so I would say, you know, I'm glad. I'm glad that you found at least some of the truth before you died. And I am glad that that happened. It changed my life. I never imagined, of course, that anybody else would be affected by what I was experiencing. I had a very personal, private, sacred experience. It never occurred to me that anyone else would ever even know about it. I was simply keeping notes in a journal, just journaling. But I was told in the dialogue, you will make of this one day a book, and it will be read by many people. And I found it hard to believe. So I said to myself, you know, I should test this out. I should just, you know, to see. So I took what I had written in my handwritten notes. It's all handwritten, no computer. I'm doing this on a yellow legal pad. I took my handwritten notes and I sent them to a stenographer, asked her if she would type it up. She typed it up on a keyboard, and then we sent it to a couple of publishers. I think there were three, not like 25 or 30, but three individual little publishing houses. And one of them, the owner of one of them, called me up and said, wow, you know, what is this? This is really remarkable stuff. We're going to publish this. I said, no, no, you're kidding. Are you kidding me? You're going to publish my handwritten notes? And they said, yeah, you know, what are you calling this? You know, why did you send this to us if you didn't want us to publish it? I said, well, I sent it on a dare, really. It was a kind of daring God. I mean, God told me that this would become a book, but I didn't believe it for a minute. I couldn't imagine, you know, any publisher going out to the workroom floor where the editors were all gathered, you know, at their desks and saying, hold the presses, stop everything. I got a guy here who's talking to God. It's not going to happen, of course. So I knew that no one was ever going to publish it. But this publishing house said, no, we do want to publish it. What should we call it? I said, well, it's, you know, I call it Conversations with God. And they didn't want to title it. They said, no, no, we can't do that. We can't call it Conversations with God. And they were not happy with the title that I had given it.
Because? They wanted it. Blasphemy.
Because they said it would be a pushback, that people would be pushed away from the material. Nobody was going to buy a book, you know, called Conversations with God. And no one would believe for a minute that anyone could have such an experience. So I said, you know what? If you don't want to call it Conversations with God, then don't publish it. And they said, well, if you feel that strongly about it, I guess we'll publish it, but it's not going to sell many copies. And they were right. It didn't sell many copies. Well, 15 million in 37 languages. But I suppose it could have sold more. And I'm not bragging. I don't want people to think I'm boasting or bragging. I'm just saying that's what happened.
This is so funny, and it's so nice also because your book has changed the lives of millions of people, including mine, by the way. Let me tell you my personal story with Conversations with God. I've been reading this book in 2007, or I started reading it. And after, I don't know, 38 or 40 pages, I just threw it in the corner. I said, this is not my style. I don't get it. What this is all about. Leave me alone, right? And at that time in 2006, 2007, I was really down. I was suffering from a broken relationship, and I didn't like my body, and everything was very, very difficult. And about 6 or 7 months later, I gave it another try and it hit me like a cannonball and it changed my life completely.
What brought you back to it 6 months later?
More suffering.
One day you just said, yeah, I'm going to pick up that old book and see what it has to offer.
I don't know. I think I was just ready. I was ready to take the next step and I didn't want to suffer anymore. Or maybe I was just listening to that voice within. I mean, nobody from the outside can make you do something. It has to come from the deep inside, from this inner voice we all have. Would you agree?
Yes, of course. I agree with everything you say.
But you can disagree too.
but you can disagree too. I'm just going to repeat everything. You know.
In therapy, they call that pacing. Did you know that?
No, I never heard that.
Yeah, when the therapist is repeating what the patient says.
Interesting.
It's a technique. It's pacing.
I never heard that. But with children in America, we have this terrible thing. We repeat everything the other person says. Mm-hmm. And to tease them, and it sometimes makes people angry mm-hmm. because all you say is what the other person said.
This is a bit crazy. Well, anyway, Neil, it's the 24th of December. It's the night before Christmas, the day Jesus Christ was born. If Jesus Christ came back today in the year 2021, what do you think would we do with him? How would we talk to him? Would we listen? Would we crucify him again? Would we recognize him? Would we recognize who he is and that he's coming in the name of love?
It's a good question. It's a very good question. I would hope that we would. It's a very good question. We might doubt everything that he had to say even more than we doubted it 2,000 years ago. Mm. But I would hope that we would listen to what he had to say and to what he said 2,000 years ago without turning it into a dogma, without turning it into a command, without making it something that we must agree with and give up our individual authority in the matter. So I would hope that we would just listen carefully to what he had to say and then give ourselves permission to apply it in our lives. I really have listened carefully to a lot of what he had to say. Love, love, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you and do good to those who would do evil to you. Mm. And when a man slaps you on the right cheek, turn and offer him your left. And when a man asks you for your coat, give him your shirt as well. Mm. And when a man asks you to walk 1 mile with him, go with him too. Mm. And don't raise your fist to heaven. Raise not your fist to heaven and curse the darkness not, but be a light unto the darkness, that you might know who you really are, and that all those whose lives you touch might know who they really are as well.
That's beautiful.
Judge not, and neither condemn.
Yeah, there's a lot of judgment in the world today. Yeah, I think it's just a very interesting mind game, what we human beings would do if Jesus Christ came back today. And yeah, the question is, would we crucify him again?
It's a good question.
Yeah.
And it would depend on how far we have advanced as a civilization, whether we can even believe, in the possibility that a divine being would visit Earth, highly evolved being, and share with us ultimate truths. And it would depend on whether those truths are consistent with what we have been told. See, as I said a while ago, the biggest challenge facing humanity is we don't like change. We really don't like change in anything. So if we are told things that are completely different. That's why they crucified Jesus to begin with.
Mm.
Because what he was saying was different from what everybody in the culture at that time was believing was true.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. And he put it very directly. He said, you know, he held up a coin. He said, God or mammon, which will it be? Can't have both. So we had this interesting situation on the planet where we had to decide who were we going to believe. And of course, they tried him and crucified him and punished him because he was saying things that were against the current understanding. Have we advanced that far in the past 2,000 years? Boy, I sure would hope so. But the challenge is we've turned the new understanding that the man called Jesus gave us into a new dogma that we now must all obey, or we are similarly going to be condemned.
Mm.
I have a hard time believing in a deity, in a higher power, who says, you know, I understand you were a kind person. You were a generous person. You were a compassionate person. You were a accepting person. You were a forgiving person. You were a loving, very loving person. I understand that you were loving, forgiving, compassionate, generous, but it doesn't matter. You happen to be Jewish, and all Jews are going to hell.
Hmm.
And all Muslims are going to hell. And all Buddhists are going to hell.
It's
and
so
all
crazy.
Hindus are going to hell. In fact, hmm. everybody is going to hell unless you happen to belong to the right religion.
Hmm. It's so
But
crazy.
If you belong to the right religion, then you don't even have to be nice and kind and compassionate and forgiving. The church had declared that if you gave enough money to the church, you could buy what the church called a plenary indulgence. That is, all of your sins would be forgiven because you gave a lot of money to the church.
Like that.
I didn't make that up. This is history.
Mm. Yeah.
That's what started the Protestant movement. That's where Lutherans came from, because Martin Luther said, that can't be right. I mean, really?
Mm-hmm.
You actually believe that? So Martin Luther started his own version of Christianity, which was called the Lutheran Church, then the Methodist Church, because it was another method to do it. So the Methodist Church, and then the Baptist Church, and then all the other Christian churches. But they still agreed on one thing. They still all agreed on one thing. You got to be Christian. Because if you're not Christian, you're going to hell.
Mm.
I mean, really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, and it would be so great if we were all just getting connected back again and everybody saying, you know, I am okay and you are okay and we are all fighting for the same thing and we all want the same and we all wish for the same. And probably this is peace on earth.
Would we dare believe in a God who is at its essence pure love? What I've suggested in the book, The God Solution, is that the solution to all of humanity's challenges, our emotional and theological and spiritual challenges that we have with each other, would be to redefine God. That is to come up with a new understanding of who and what God is. To say that God actually is pure love, that God can be defined in two words, pure love. Now, when I tell people this in lectures in front of an audience, somebody inevitably stands up in the back of the room and says, oh, Neil, really? I mean, we've listened to you for the past 25 minutes, and your revolutionary idea is that God is love. Every religion agrees on that. All religions say that God is love. And I have to say to the audience, wait a minute. I didn't say God is love. I said God is pure love.
Mm.
And there's a huge difference. Now the guy in the back of the room says, all right, what's the difference? The difference is that pure love needs nothing from us. demands nothing from us, requires nothing from us, and commands nothing of us. It simply loves us and gives us, through the joy of its love, all the gifts that we need to create the life that we wish to experience. Now, that's theologically revolutionary. Can we imagine, can we really believe in a God who demands nothing, who commands nothing, who requires nothing, and who needs nothing? Or do we believe in a God who needs, you don't understand, God needs us to worship him. God needs us to worship him in only this particular way, one way. And if you don't do it the right way, you're out. You're in trouble. So the God solution is suggests that if we came up with a brand new global ethic, which is what would result if we had a new definition of God, because we're using our current definition of God as our global ethic. This is our ethical standard. We treat others the way God treats us, with judgment, condemnation, and punishment. Mm-hmm. And we call it love. People say, yeah, God loves us. God only judges us because he loves us and wants us to do what's right. And so if we don't do what's right, we're going to be judged and we're going to be condemned and we're going to be punished. But judging and condemning and punishing is a demonstration of God's love. So we use that as our justification to judge, condemn, and punish each other. After all, if it's good enough for God, it's good enough for us. We're simply modeling God's behavior. But if we decided that we've made a mistake here, I mean, what if we decided that maybe we've made a mistake here? Maybe God needs nothing from us and commands nothing of us and requires nothing. If that were true, we would create a whole new global ethic that would permeate our politics, our economics, our social systems, and yes, our spirituality. The whole way we live our lives would be changed forever, because we would be repeating our new understanding of God's behavior. And we could say to each other in this world, I don't need anything. I don't require anything from you. You don't have to be a Democrat or a Republican or a conservative. You don't have to be a liberal. You don't have to have belong to a certain economic group. You don't have to belong to a certain nationality. You don't have to belong to a certain religion. You don't have to do any of those things. You can simply be your authentic self.
Paradise, when we treat
heaven on earth.
When we treat each other like that.
Yeah, heaven on earth. We've been promised that we would create heaven on earth, but only on the day when we truly understood who and what God is and what God wants. I wrote a book, by the way, called What God Wants. And there's a particular chapter in that book that describes exactly what God wants. When you get to that chapter, it's astonishing, because people turn the page to that chapter and they can't believe what they see on the pages of that chapter.
They're empty.
They're blank. They're empty. The publisher didn't want to publish the book with blank pages in it because they said they increased the cost, the unit cost of the book. So I said, either you publish the book with blank pages or we're not going to publish it, because that's the whole point of the book. Mm-hmm. The book is called What God Wants, and I want to make the point by having like 12 or 8 or 10 blank pages so that people can be shocked. Can that possibly be true? Mm-hmm. Can we believe in a God who wants nothing? I mean, that's theologically revolutionary.
Yeah, that will be the love revolution and the God solution, maybe. Neil, it was so much fun talking to you. I thank you so, so much for spending this last hour with me and with our listeners here in Germany at Christmas. I don't want to steal your time anymore, but before I leave you, I would, of course, like to know, how do you spend the holidays? What does Christmas mean to you? You like it?
No, it's a horrible day. I never want to have another Christmas again. Because I'm the Grinch who stole Christmas, and no, of course it's a wonderful day, because you know Christmas gives us permission to just love each other, no matter what. You know, even the wayward uncle who comes to the house once a year is invited in for Christmas dinner. Come on in, uncle. Come on in. You know, because all of a sudden, people are nice to each other. Even just walking down the street, mm-hmm. people are nice to each other. So what you said at the beginning of the program is true. Christmas does, for a lot of people, even people who are not belonging to a particular religion, it does bring us a sense of joy and the wonderment and the happiest aspects of life. So mm-hmm. how I spend Christmas? With my family and in a place where I'm just so ready to be happy, and joyful, and merry. So, glückliches Weihnachten.
Oh, das war gar nicht schlecht. Glückliche Weihnachten. Neil Donald Walsh, thank you so much for talking to us. And I wish you from the bottom of my heart just all the best for your future for the next year. And thank you, by the way, also for all this precious content you are giving into this world who has never visited your website. It's just amazing what you're doing there. And yeah, just thank you so much.
Well, you're very sweet to say those things. That's really? Very nice. I wish I could say those things in German. Aber ich habe nicht Deutsch gesprochen, kleine Deutsch gesprochen. In Schule, ich habe gelernt Deutsch kleine.
That was easy to understand. It was very good.
Ah, sehr gut. Sehr gut, mein Herr.
My teacher God will appreciate that. You're not
My
going to hell
to
today.
Neil thank Donald you for Walsh. Those nice words. Thank you for your invitation and thank you for the opportunity to share this time with you.
Thank you very much. Take good care and
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Christmas
bye, bye.
Eve. Yes. Bye.
Bye. Was für ein kluger, lustiger und warmherziger Mensch. Unglaublich. Schöne Folge zu Weihnachten. Ich fasse mich ausnahmsweise mal kurz. Ich wünsche euch ein frohes Fest. Ich hoffe, ihr kommt zur Ruhe. Gebt gut Acht auf euch und eure Lieben. Und wir hören uns wieder in der nächsten Folge. Merry Christmas.
Get Happy. Der Achtsamkeitspodcast von Antenne Bayern.